It's moving. Yep. Okay. Last week we took a look at the unknown false messiahs, and I forgot to explain where that title came from. That was actually Rabbi Blau's idea that we titled that, and I said, why? He said, because nobody knows about them. So it's sort of unknown in the sense that most people aren't familiar with their stories. In terms of history, we do have a certain amount of documentation, and I more or less gave you the basic documentation on each of them. By the time we get to the 17th century, though, and we begin the story of Shabtai Tzvi, he is much more well-known, both in terms of his time, because it pretty much covered the whole Jewish world. You have another handy-dandy map this week on the last page that you can tear off or not. Once again, the map does not really cover the full area. Shabtai Tzvi's influence went also all the way down into Yemen. And there's even some indications that people in the New World at least knew about it. But also in terms of history, not only at that time was he extremely well known, but his life is enormously well documented. The entire incident is enormously documented. And in fact, I'll show it to you. This book is Gershom Sholem's masterwork of scholarship. It's basically the story of Shabtai Tzvi. It was written in Hebrew. Let's see when. 1957. This translation in English is from 1973. And it is really, if you want to see what real scholarship is, what a real master of digging up sources and finding them and identifying them and translating them and putting them together meticulously to piece together a story, his work is unsurpassed. I have to admit that I am not completely up to date on the scholarship of Shabtai Tzvi. Over the last couple of years, there have been a couple of books that have come out. Some of them have been poorly reviewed. One of them actually was Matt Goldish, who came and spoke here. Remember Vicky? Yeah, Vicky had me over her house so I could drill him for a while for when he's here on Shalosh Shittas. And I haven't read his book yet. But when he was here, I asked him, he told me he was working on it, and I said, I was asking him all these different questions about Gershom Sholem's book. And he said, well, that's the book, if you're writing about Shabtai Tzvi, you have to relate to. I'm not contradicting his work, I'm simply providing some more broad context. So in terms of what we're doing tonight, I think we'll be okay trying to get through this. I think that should give us enough material. Next week, we will be looking at the messianic idea in terms of how it relates to us, because we've looked at sort of a depressing look last week at mistaken approaches to the messianic idea. Tonight, we are going to once again look at a disastrous approach to the messianic idea. And next week, we will devote to how I think we as contemporary Jews should really relate to it. I don't want us to walk away with a sort of cynical or pessimistic approach. I don't think that really has an appropriate place within Jewish life. But tonight I really want to begin on a similar note, which is not to have a negative view of a very important area of Judaism, and that is Jewish mysticism. It's very easy to walk out after learning about Shabtai Tzvi or reading about it and thinking, oh, this is a bunch of bizarre, cuckoo, nutty stuff. And it's a very rich part of our intellectual heritage, and it should be treated as such. And so I really wanted to open up talking about what role mysticism is supposed to play, what is mysticism and what isn't mysticism. And I think that will be somewhat helpful as we move on. All right. Now, our guide, I would consider using Gershom Sholem for it, but Gershom Sholem was not a religious man. So I don't know that from a traditional perspective we could completely rely on his opinions. Rav Kook, on the other hand, was a pretty religious guy, I think. I think he's all right. We're safe with him. I don't know if he's in the window, but he's all around the walls. I don't know if he made it to the window at all, did he? I can't tell. It's too dark. It's big enough. I don't need my glasses for it, but I don't think so. Not in the window, just on the walls. Oh, yeah? No. All right. Just the ticker tape going along the ticker, you know, like in the Times Square? Right. All right. Rav Kook approached the world in terms of the two people that we lean on, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Kook. Rav Soloveitchik had an appreciation for Kabbalistic thought. He had a sort of affection for it, would occasionally reference it to explain his ideas. Rav Kook was not a casual user of mystical ideas. His philosophy, his whole approach to life and knowledge and the world was based on and steeped in mystical thought. So somebody of his intellectual prowess and religious height, I think, is a good person to articulate for us what makes it so wonderful, but also what are its boundaries. And here I think we're going to have to define some terms in his language. When he says pure knowledge, I think what he's referring to is knowledge that we know completely and concretely, science. You have to realize that, without going through the history of Western philosophy, but in our age, we live in an age where we've pretty much divided the... In antiquity, when we said studying things about the world, we said philosophy, and it pretty much covered everything. Today, science, modern science, starting with Descartes' skepticism and moving on to empiricism, science basically lays claim to describing the world as it is. Sometimes in detail, sometimes in a more general sense, how things interact. But science simply describes the world as it is. It only discusses things that can be disproven. What about philosophy? Well, there's things about the world that are not subject to proof or disproof. The existence of God. What does it mean to be a good person? What's the best way to form a government? That's not the same as what is the speed of light. Things of that nature. So that's the area, things that cannot be proven or disproven are philosophy. And mysticism is a different area still. Love of pure knowledge must be constrained that it not hinder us from continually desiring what is higher and more sublime than our pure knowledge, to what we can attain only by direct speculations, hidden feelings, and at times by meditations of the heart and imaginings, like visions and waking dreams. Here Rav Kook is responding to a sort of modern perspective that many people have, that if it's not concrete knowledge, if it's not something that I can prove or disprove, if it's not science, then it really shouldn't be part of my worldview. I shouldn't be dealing with it at all. I don't know, that could either be an atheistic approach to the world or an agnostic approach to the world. Either I'm saying that there's nothing else for me to think about, or since everything else is unknowable, it really doesn't relate to me in any way and I shouldn't consider it important. And Rav Kook is saying, he's not diminishing the importance of the love for pure knowledge, by meaning science, but he's saying, that should not cut off the outlet to the other types of knowledge. For just as they can harm us, meaning these types of speculations, when out of laziness and used by science to gain possession of its clear knowledge, so they can ennoble us, grounding the parts familiar to us with greater clarity and elevating our entire being when they come from things exalted and beyond the grasp of our knowledge. In other words, what Rav Kook is talking about is there are things that we can describe with science. There are even things that philosophy can lay out, whether that's ethical philosophy, political philosophy, theology, the study of God. But at a certain point, philosophy gets to a limit. If you study Maimonides, and we've been basing our approach to the Messiah on him, if you study his theology, you end up with a very dry, distant picture of God. A very difficult idea of God to relate to. Maimonides logically describes mostly what we don't know about God, and in detail, why we know so little about God, and how we relate to attributes that we recognize are metaphor. And by the time he's done describing this distant, transcendent God, it almost doesn't feel like somebody you would pray to. So distant and far away. Because the rational mind can only assume so much. We are a religion that believes that the rational process is crucial to our religious experience. It's involved and invested in everything that we do. But we also recognize that there are limits. And certainly in understanding God as himself, and even to a certain extent how he relates to the world, we recognize that the rational mind is going to be a somewhat limited tool. And so we need to turn to what Rav Kook is saying some might think of as silly musings, but Rav Kook is treating it as sort of meta-rational. There are areas of the world and areas of life that are beyond the rational. The rational mind is a limited tool, and to comprehend it, we have to access more poetic, more imaginative aspects of our personalities. And just because sometimes those can be dangerous, if used improperly, that doesn't mean that it isn't a rich part of our religious life that we should make sure that we use. Well, then how do we do that, Rav Kook? How do we use artistic musings and imaginings without them uprooting us from the truth? If only the content is not changed, letting the speculative concept be held as a scientific one, or an imaginary idea as something speculative, intellectual, and so on, for then one can be snared in the net of error. But when one is cautious of the limits of his understanding and knows how to go beyond the revealed to the concealed, to things so lofty and sublime that his only access is through speculation and imagination, then man will discover the power of heaven, and the supernal light will shine in him, for his way is before the Lord. In other words, what Rav Kook is advocating is, know the boundaries of each. If somebody tells you that through science we can discern what is the proper way for a person to act, what is ethical, that's narishkeit. Science can't do that. Science describes the world as it is. It can't describe ethical behavior. If somebody tells me through philosophy I can understand the human genome, that's silly. That's not the realm of philosophy. We have to be able to learn each within its own realm. So too, says Rav Kook, the speculative aspect of our thought, the imaginary aspect, where we use images and metaphors and ideas that in many ways express truths that are meaningful to us, enriches our lives religiously. They're very powerful. But I don't confuse them with philosophy, nor do I confuse them with science. I don't describe reality based on my religious musings. I look at reality and use my religious musings to have a religious connection to what's around me. But I don't put the cart before the horse. And then he goes on. Rav Kook says that these boundaries are not static. The boundaries get pushed. Imaginary parts become speculation. Some speculations become knowledge. Right? As the boundaries of science move on, things that we sort of speculated about may end up being proven, and then we know about them. And so the boundary gets pushed further out. Now what we sort of philosophically try to rationally guess at becomes fact. And now the realm of mystical thought, the realm of imagery and ideas and metaphors, becomes even further out. And what Rav Kook is really emphasizing here is that if you can avoid the danger, if you can avoid the pitfalls, then you have a very rich way, you've engaged this aspect of your soul that God gave you, to relate to the world in very meaningful terms. But the danger is always there. That's pretty abstract. Let's take this Kabbalistic idea, and by the way, a lot of people get very nervous when you talk about learning something in Kabbalah. Where does that come from? Where does that negative feeling people have? Oh, you're supposed to wait till you're 40. I'm not supposed to learn that. I'm not supposed to know that. Where historically does that approach come from?
story where four people were making mistakes?
No, because that you're talking about, it's not clear exactly what that's talking about, obviously, but you're talking about people who are entering, the Pardes is the heights of the mystical understanding, whatever that is. Here we're talking about accessing simple, basic Kabbalistic text. What could be the problem? Where historically does that come from? That was already a result of this approach. And it begins, of course, with Shabtai Tzvi. In the aftermath of Shabtai Tzvi, Kabbalah and mystical thinking and practice got an enormous black eye. The Hasidim, in their early stages, were viewed with tremendous distrust because much of what they did seemed Sabbatean. In other words, that whole approach to Judaism was tainted. And for years, other people who tried to branch off, trying to revive this approach, were chased away and destroyed as pariahs. We'll get to that a little bit later. But it's a post-Sabbatean world where we look at Kabbalah with real distrust. Now, let's take a look at some of this basic, one basic Kabbalistic idea from the Kabbalistic revolution in the 16th century in Sfat. I got this off a website that's explaining Jewish ideas and historical things in simple language, so I figured that should be helpful. These are not easy ideas. Kabbalah's greatest period, which is the guy's opinion, but it's hard to argue, was under the charismatic leadership of Isaac Luria, known as the Ari. Through discussions with his disciples, the Ari provided a philosophical system to the discipline of Kabbalah, which had influenced Kabbalah even to this day. He practically wrote nothing. Everything was written down by his disciples. Historically, there's a big fight with disciple you're supposed to trust. They didn't get along so well after he died. He's saying Chaim Vital. It's impossible to describe Lurianic Kabbalah, but with understanding that all descriptions are already false because words oversimplify, this is an attempt. Luria concentrated on the process of creation. Originally, the divine created with too much emanation. It was more than any creation could bear, even spiritual sphero, and those original vessels exploded, producing shards which poison all subsequent creations. Those shards are the source of what we call evil in our world. Luria's Kabbalah begins with this idea that before the world was created, God contracted his essence, whatever that means. That empty space, the vacuum created by God's contraction, is the world. And the contraction isn't a neat, simple contraction. That void, the emanations of God are distributed into the world. And they were supposed to be distributed through these vessels, but the vessels shattered. So that the metaphysical nature of the universe isn't working properly. There are all these broken vessels, spiritually speaking. That's why there is evil in the world. They are what cause evil. So now you have a little theosophy in there. And embedded on these shards of the broken vessels, which were supposed to contain God's light, but didn't, are little sparks. So in the evil are pieces of good. Evil began because of good. You have this complicated idea. The idea was that they would be sort of the filters through which God's emanation would reach the world, but the filters themselves were overwhelmed and shattered. Now the idea is they can be repaired, and they will be repaired.
Didn't God have control over them?
You are asking rational questions on what is meant to be a potent, powerful image. I said before that the Rambam's rational philosophy, at least for many, leaves you feeling disconnected from this transcendent God. The Ari's Kabbalah, which says that everything in existence is filled with the emanation of God, and that my job is to repair those broken vessels, to release the light, the sparks of light that are still in them, to repair the universe, so that we and God can interact the way we were meant to, that's very intimate. And that's very powerful. That's very moving. Every act that a Jew does, in some way, is fixing these vessels, so that my relationship with God is very strong. This is what I mean by meta-rational. Can I logically put together this structure and logically explain it, defend it? No. But logically, I can't really describe God's creation of the world very well either. Philosophy ends up with these brick walls at this question. It does. Why did God make the world? What does he need it for? He's perfect. Why did God allow evil? If he knows everything and is all powerful, and he's all good, then why would he allow evil at all? So this is taking those questions which rational philosophy simply can't solve, and say, let's look at it from another way. Let's use imagery and metaphor to understand our relationship to God. And Rav Kook is saying, that's very enriching. That's very potent. That stimulates my life. If you want to understand Hasidic fervor, then understand that idea. That every time I do a mitzvah, it's not just that I'm fulfilling an order, a command that was given to me. I have done something to repair the fabric of the cosmos. And every time I do a sin, God forbid, I am helping unravel increasing entropy in the spiritual universe. And only when we, as a group, through our efforts, through the mitzvot that we do, through the intention that we have during prayer, overwhelm the damage and finally reconstruct, then the universe will function properly and all evil will be defeated. That's powerful. That's powerful. And it leads people to passionate religious expression. If my kavanah, when I daven, will repair the universe, and faulty kavanah will not, I'm going to have better kavanah. These are potent, important images that have a very important place in Jewish thought and Jewish life. If, for many Jews, the Kabbalistic worldview isn't part of their everyday interaction with Judaism, I think that's okay too. Whatever, in other words, the Rambam did not like things that weren't rational. And like Rav Kook, I think he also was a pretty religious guy, right? Whatever elevated him to his religious connection to God, whatever excited him and got him to be a better servant of God, if that's what worked for him, that's great. For a lot of people, the rational approach works. For a lot of people, this mystical language is extremely helpful. And that's great. Again, where is the danger? When my philosophy, whether it be mystical or rational, becomes the way I describe reality, and it predefines my description of reality, now we're going to have problems. Okay. I think that's, in a 20-minute introduction to Kabbalah, I think that's about as clear as I can get it. I think it'll become clearer as we go on. Is this a clarification question?
Yeah, where do you get this from?
Well, that's part of the problem. In other words, the word Kabbalah implies that it's received information. And it's tradition. But there's no question that there's an enormous amount of creativity involved. Part of the danger in this area is, how can I be artistically creative and still know that I'm being artistically creative within the framework of Jewish thought? And how do I know I haven't pushed past the boundary? The Ari's formulations were novel. And yet, it's been accepted as authentically Jewish. How do you know? So that's hard. And sometimes the boundaries are hard to define. Shabtai Tzvi is not one of those people where the boundaries are hard to define. He shatters them quite completely. There's no gray area. There are, however, gray areas in mystical philosophy that are problematic. But again, my subject tonight isn't Kabbalah, my subject is Shabtai Tzvi. But we simply can't discuss Shabtai Tzvi unless we understand it. One of Gershon Sholem's big revolutions in the world of scholarship was, he tried to explain how, we learned last week about several of these people. Their effect was pretty localized. The David Alroy, for instance, who was in, where was he, in Kurdistan. So people heard about him in Baghdad, and there was the whole thing about flying away on the roof. Okay, but that's not a contiguous, you know, relationship of his followers. That's people in a different city who heard a rumor and blew it out of control. Shabtai Tzvi's followers were pretty much everywhere Jews were. This explosion, this acceptance, universal acceptance of this person as a Messiah is unprecedented in Jewish history, and there hasn't been anyone who's pulled it off since. And what Shalom, historians couldn't explain it. Why? Why was this guy more successful than any of the rest of them? Shalom was the first person to argue. It's because of the Ari. The Ari's mystical philosophy was so popular, and it first permeated the entire Jewish world, the world of Ashkenaz and the world of Sfarad. And people were so familiar with these mystical ideas about repairing the world through spiritual forces that it paved the way for them to be able to accept a mystical Messiah. And that's when Kabbalah becomes everyone's everyday experience, and you begin to define the world that way, then the idea of a mystical Messiah becomes more credible. Let's take a look. Here's an outline, and we'll fill in where we need to. Now, the birthday at the 9th of Av, that's not 100% for sure true. It may be. We have no evidence that it's not true. Again, the documentation of his life is very thorough. But his birthday, we only find out in documents written once he's already somewhat famous. All the documentation indicates he was born on the 9th of Av, but it may be apocryphal. Why would that have been made up? Well, there's a midrash that says that the Messiah will be born on the 9th of Av. That midrash is obviously talking about, you know, that in every tragedy there's the potential for redemption. But if you take that midrash literally, and then he's born on the 9th of Av, that comes out pretty cool. It may be true. Stranger things have happened. He's born into a wealthy family. He was, as a young man, an excellent student. And we don't know for sure, but probably somewhere between 15 and 18, he achieved the status of Chacham, which in the Sephardi world is like basically a rabbi. After he finished his education, which he was not a well-renowned scholar, but not bad, he started living in semi-seclusion. He felt uncomfortable living with other people and begins to suffer massive mood swings. Now, we find it tempting to, with absolutely no, well, some of us here do have some professional training in these areas, but even those of us who don't always find it tempting to diagnose people whose behavior we think is odd. Right? The professionals are giggling, I see, because they know it's true. To do that to somebody who we know, who's alive today, who we interact with, is, of course, incredibly, probably inappropriate and certainly fraught with difficulty to do with any sort of sense of honesty. To do it to somebody who lived in the 17th century is also pretty darn difficult. But if we allow ourselves to give in to temptation for just a moment, he experiences devastating lows where he barely can function. He doesn't want to be around people. And huge, sometimes bizarre highs. He seems bipolar. If there's ever anyone on the record who you can historically diagnose, and I actually brought some of these things to nobody here, but a different psychiatrist who said, wow, that's bipolar, all right. That's textbook. He really does. He really fits. But also with, really hypermanic. And also, what do you call it when his actions are really irrational? Not scary. Nobody was scared of him during this stage. Absolutely.
It's so incredibly believable because it's what we call they were egocentric. He honestly believed.
That there's no question. At this time, nobody thought of him as anything but a kook. He's this young guy, probably in his late teens or 20s. He begins to do very strange actions. One thing he keeps doing is finding reasons and ways to pronounce God's name properly, the way we're not supposed to say, right? The Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. He keeps saying it out loud and saying that that's very important to do. Why? We need to do it. I need to do it. You should do it too. He begins to publicly commit sins. And also, and as we go on, at this stage we don't know what they were so much. These are not so well documented in his youth. But we'll see as he gets older the form that these take. And he probably at this point already started calling himself the Messiah. But again, he's treated as just this poor guy who seemed like a promising young scholar, and he just went nuts. And he's treated as a nut. His behavior was probably somewhat promiscuous. Oddly enough, he marries his family, who are wealthy merchants in the area, respected people. They try to settle him down. He marries and divorces his wives. His wives say the marriage was never consummated, and so they didn't want to be in that marriage. When he comes out of these manic states and people ask him, why did you say God's name? Why are you singing out loud in the middle of town? I have no idea. It made sense to me at the time, and right now I don't know why. And he would sometimes sink into these horrible, depressed melancholies. Now, 1648 to 1649 in the Ukraine, we know that because he writes about it, and the people around him wrote about it. Students of his later on in life, people who, and what's going to happen is those behaviors become part of the proof that he's the Messiah. So that they become described in great detail as being religiously crucial to who he is. So we have them described in minute detail. But not in a psychological term. They're described as there's a mystical process. His followers believe there's a mystical process going on inside him. Well, his problem is that he's got an audience who believes him. In 1648 and 1649, it's known as Gzeirat Tachfetat, the massacre, the Khmelnytsky massacres. And up until Shalom, people pretty much said that it was because of the aftermath of Gzeirat Tachfetat that people were so desperate to believe in a Messiah that that's what made Shabbat Tzvi so successful. Shalom finds it unlikely for many reasons, not the least of which is that the massacres are pretty localized. Shabbat Tzvi's success wasn't. Now, at some point, between 1651 and 1654, Shabtai Tzvi's public behavior becomes so inappropriate, his outward violation of the Torah, yet doing it, quoting Psalms, running up into Shul and davening for the Amud, becomes so intrusive into people's traditional lives that he is thrown out of the city. He begins to wander. He travels around Turkey and Greece. In Salonika, he's expelled again because he prepares a wedding. And people don't know exactly who he is. The wedding, they come, and he has a Sefer Torah under a chuppah, and he performs, as the performer of the wedding, he performs this wedding between him and the Sefer Torah. He did not refer to himself there as the Messiah. That seems to have only happened. He only proclaimed himself the Messiah at all during his youth. At this next stage, he doesn't seem to refer to himself that way. And he has this other bizarre thing where he decides one week to celebrate Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot completely. And people are always focusing on him. Apparently, he was incredibly charismatic. Several different descriptions of him describe that not only did they think he was good-looking, although, I don't know, the picture apparently is an accurate portrait. Seems not so great to me. But apparently he had an enormous amount of personality and charisma. In fact, several of the people describe him as having a really good smell. Now, this is not talking about cologne or anything like that. Apparently, he just gave off this, he had good BO. That's what they, I don't know. Several people describe that he, some, I don't know. So he's very public in his behavior, attracts a lot of attention. He seems very impressive when you talk to him. And then suddenly he sort of slips into this weirdness. He begins to look around for people who can help him. Because his problems are obviously making it unable for him to live a healthy, normal, productive life. And he begins to look around for ways to solve this problem. Now, how is he going to do that in 17th century Jewish world? Well, he'd already studied Kabbalah. He talks to rabbis, he talks to Kabbalists, he tries to come up with rituals or prayers or ceremonies that will cure him of what he assumes is some sort of demonic possession. Doesn't work. Moves to Israel. In Israel, for whatever reason, he achieved some measure of success from his attempts in Constantinople to rid himself of these swains. It's a temporary success. But when he arrives in Jerusalem, he presents himself to the rabbis and interacts with them in a way that's perfectly acceptable. They actually, there's one point where they had to send a delegation to talk to the community in Egypt, and they send him as one of their representatives. He's impressive, charismatic, knowledgeable, perfect, you go. He goes, he comes back, everything is fine.
Well,
how much do you know about a Jew living in Italy right now? And you live in an age of instant communication. How many people with mental problems do you know in Russia right now? There was a kook in Constantinople, so in Jerusalem they know of him. There were kooks, believe me, he wasn't the only kook. He marries his third wife. Strangely enough, she is a woman who everybody talks about with a reputation. I think she was from Italy and her parents sent her away to Israel, something that actually sometimes goes on today, because they wanted to get her out of their hair. And somehow she ends up with him, and he begins to suffer these episodes again, and he pursues through prayer and practical Kabbalah. Whatever he did in Constantinople was wearing off. And so he decides to solve it again. 1665 is the year where everything goes wrong. Shabtai Tzvi in Jerusalem hears that in Gaza is a master Kabbalist. Also a pretty young guy, not really far in age from Shabtai Tzvi. His picture, and also it's an accurate picture, is on the next page. I don't know what's up with the Ticho. But that's Nathan of Gaza. Nathan of Gaza, and we have testimony for this. You would walk over to Nathan of Gaza and say, what am I doing wrong and how do I become better? And this is the testimony. Nathan of Gaza would look you in the eye, describe your sins, describe your soul to you, and tell you what you needed to do to fix it. And people walked away in wonder, but also very moved and would turn their lives around. Now, I've seen guys on TV talking to dead people, the John Edwards guy. I don't know if he's a scam artist or if he really believes he's doing something. I think he's a charlatan. Nathan of Gaza pulled off this thing that impressed people tremendously. I can't imagine. Here's the problem. If he really had these amazing abilities, he's about to declare, using these same abilities, Shabtai Tzvi the Messiah. So, you got it or you don't. And anyway, Shabtai Tzvi hears of his reputation, that was close enough that he heard of him, heads over, Nathan says, oh my gosh, I saw you in a vision, sir. You are the Messiah. Shabtai Tzvi says, I can't possibly be the Messiah. I came to you because I am a tortured, miserable, suffering soul. Nathan says, hello, that's what messiahs are. Tortured, miserable, suffering souls. You have the fate of the world upon you, sir. You are, it, through your soul, is grabbing at the essence of the universe. It's grasping at those broken vessels and elevating the sparks out of them. Releasing the good trapped under the evil of the cosmos. That's your depressive states. Your depressive states are when you are down trying to fix these vessels. Then the sparks arise and you experience the highs of repairing the universe. And then you descend into the next one. Now I recognize that it's unintentional, that you're not doing it consciously. But you can't help it. Your soul is the Messiah soul. The soul that was mystically sent to earth to repair the universe. And on a historical level, to return the Jewish nation to their homeland. That's you. It takes him 2 months to convince Shabtai Tzvi. Poor Shabtai Tzvi. This is a guy. Gershon Shalom says, Nathan of Gaza was his John the Baptist and his Paul. He inspired him on his mission and then turned his mission into this whole other religious approach. Because Nathan of Gaza was the... Shabtai Tzvi was an okay scholar, not particularly creative. He could talk. He could handle. Nathan of Gaza was exceptional. And it's Nathan of Gaza who, again, I think, and sincerely believe in what he was saying, who forms this philosophy as things go on. Nathan of Gaza declares that the fast of the 17th of Tammuz has to be canceled. Shabtai Tzvi, by the way, gets run out of Jerusalem when he returns because of his bizarre behavior. At this point, he's just peaks and valleys, because now he's not even trying. He considers this a boon. He's very happy that he suffers. So he's just all over the place. They throw him out of Jerusalem for his behavior. He also appointed the leaders of the 12 tribes from people that he met and told them, now he's telling everyone he's the Messiah, everyone should get ready. Nathan sends out letters declaring that the 17th of Tammuz, the fast where we mourn the breaking the walls of Jerusalem, is now canceled because we're entering the Messianic age. Interestingly, declares that signs and wonders are not to be expected. Interestingly, following the approach of the Rambam that we saw the first week, of course, what are the first rumors? When people first hear about Shabtai Tzvi, what's the first thing they hear? There's a man in Israel who's performing miracles and wonders. That's the first thing they hear. There's a man in Israel who knows where the 12 lost tribes are. He's organized them and is getting ready to invade and take over Israel. The 12 lost tribes are at the gates of Mecca, being led by a guy, we don't know his name, but he's healing people and he can fly and all of that. So Nathan of Gaza's attempt to get out of this miracle mindset was a waste of time, because Shabtai Tzvi's legend preceded him as always being able to perform these bizarre miracles. He also says that the Ari's system of repairing the pieces of the universe is now antiquated, because it is being done by the Messiah. And our job now is no longer to repair the fragments of the universe. It's being done before our eyes by this one man. Our job is to now prepare us as a nation for his saving of us. And he gives a date, June 1866. Nathan does. Shabtai Tzvi later confirms that this is the date because he knows it too. But it was Nathan who said it and he repeats it. Yeah. I don't remember. There was a lot of...
Tuba or something.
No, it's not a particularly important Hebrew date. In the Christian world right now, a lot of these, a lot of groups were talking about this being the age of the second coming because it's the Antichrist number in there. So it was a time in the... I don't think in the Muslim world, but Jews in Christian areas were picking up on this vibe also. Tzvi passes through Aleppo. Redemption means all the Jews will be taken back to Israel. passes through Aleppo, leaving his first group of a community now that believes in him and supports him. Goes back home to Smyrna. Yeah, he passes through Syria on his way back to Turkey. And begins performing strange acts. Now these we know. These are described because people are excited to see the Messiah. He somehow gets, he walks around dressed as a king. He goes from shul to shul, leading services. The services are not necessarily the services you would find in a siddur, but they are composed of bits and pieces rearranged of Tehillim or whatever. They're largely self-composed, and apparently he has a gorgeous singing voice. So people are overwhelmed by this presence. He begins to go back to this need to perform sins publicly and begins to eat forbidden fats and asking other people to do it too as part of his system. There are people in Smyrna who are buying into this hook, line, and sinker. Shabtai's followers call them Ma'aminim, and anyone who's suspicious or skeptical about Shabtai Tzvi as the Messiah is called a kofer. So in other words, if you are skeptical, you are impious. Shabtai Tzvi leads a group, there's one particular shul where people are pretty skeptical. Shabtai leads a group of followers, comes with an axe on the door, smashes down the door in the middle of tefillah, goes up onto their bima, opens up the Torah to, not the Parsha, but just whatever, starts reading it, and then sings a beautiful Turkish love song, a ballad, to the Torah. Secular, somewhat erotic, it was his favorite song. And he sings it to the Torah, and of course everybody's explaining, ah, now we see the beautiful mystical imagery that was really hidden, and look how he elevates these things that were hidden underneath all along, and shows their holiness. People begin to experience prophecy. Somewhere between 150 and 200 people in Smyrna experience prophecy. Here is a quote from a Dutch merchant who was in Smyrna at the time. At that time there appeared more than 200 prophets and prophetesses, upon whom there fell a mighty trembling so that they swooned. In this state they exclaimed that Shabtai Tzvi was the Messiah King of Israel and would lead his people safely to the Holy Land, and that ships with Dutch crews would come and transport them. Thereafter their spirits returned to them, but they remembered nothing of what they had spoken. Even little children of 4 years or less recited Psalms in Hebrew, which they obviously didn't speak. So that people begin to perform acts of prophecy, which they claim you could empirically prove about. They're saying things, knowing things, and languages that they can't understand, speaking in tongues. This is classic in the world of religion. It just rarely finds a place in Jewish history. But interestingly, the merchant goes on and he says, the Jews are so shocked. We've seen this, we Christians. I mean, I was shocked the Jews had such an experience. Okay. Now the news spreads, and the rumors catch like wildfire everywhere Jews live, and I'm not exaggerating. What happens? An enormous tshuva movement takes place. Tshuva on an enormous scale. People know that the Messianic era is coming. That means the day of judgment is coming, and they are terrified that they will be found wanting when the ultimate judgment comes. And so, people begin ritual bathing. They begin fasting. We have people who fast all week long. Weaker people are fasting, 4 or 5 days a week. Children are fasting Mondays and Thursdays. Parents who want to purify their whole family. There are documented cases of people who starve themselves to death in their fervor to repent. Constant ritual bathing. People giving out all their money to charity. Also, people whipping themselves, people rolling around naked in the snow, things to mortify their flesh so that they can repair their infinite sins. People sold off all their property, getting ready for the big move, to Goyim who were buying it on the cheap. Yep, pennies on the dollar, right? What are you going to do with it? June 18, 1666, you're out of here. I'll give you $50 for your house. Also, in the rabbinic literature, because this is not a movement of poor people or rich people or learned people or lay people, everyone. Not, when I say everyone, I don't mean everyone. There were skeptics who didn't believe in it. Mostly they shut their mouths. Why? Two reasons. They were afraid of getting beat up, because that happened. And number two is rabbis who were skeptical were afraid to stop the repentance fervor. What am I going to do? I'm going to tell people it's not the Messiah. Stop doing tshuva. No. Such a thing. Look, okay, so it's crazy, but they're doing tshuva. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if you would call them more halakhically observant, rolling around naked in the snow. Giving away all your money is not tshuva. They're trying to prepare for judgment day. Part of that is, one of the things that we find in the rabbinic literature is, rabbis are saying, look, everybody in business, you've done this or you've done that, you better fix it. If you have any money that you've gotten, any taxes that you owe, any debts that you haven't repaid, you better give back all your ill-gotten gains. Shellen points out, of all the record of behavior, there's not a single documented case of anybody doing that. All of the tshuva that they perform is personal. There's no examples of tshuva. Right.
So how does
it doesn't. They don't know about that. These people never met Sabtai Tzvi. They probably don't have a single accurate report of Sabtai Tzvi. They just know that there is such a guy. He performs miracles. He's leading the 12 tribes. They know almost nothing, but they better get ready because here it comes. And so in different communities, there are slightly different approaches, but overall, this is a pretty good summary of what goes on. Sabtai Tzvi travels to Constantinople, and he's arrested. Why is he arrested? Well, you have this person is the person everybody's saying is going to take over. Nathan of Gaza said explicitly, in a bloodless coup, he will take over from the Sultan of Turkey and run the Turkish Empire. This is what everybody's saying about him. Now, it was a bloodless coup. It's not clear, though, why they're being so nice to him. They arrest him, but don't kill him. To which, of course, Sabtai Tzvi's followers say, you see, any other guy would have gotten killed. The fact that he's alive proves that he's the Messiah.
But there were reports that there was a very good reason for them not to kill him because Jesus
right.
was killed, and look what happened.
It's possible that he didn't want to make a martyr that would cause more problems. That's one of the possibilities. We don't know why.
That was
absolutely a very strong possibility of one. He was afraid of making a martyr. He refuses to be ransomed, which of course only makes his legend grow stronger. At some point he's moved to Gallipoli, where he's placed not in a dungeon, but in a tower under guard, and he's living, it's fairly comfortable. His followers call it the Tower of Strength. He's allowed to see visitors. And again, he continues with his behavior. He's not only is he eating chalev now, forbidden fat, but he's feeding it to people. And when they eat it, by the way, they have to say a blessing. There's a blessing that we say every morning, Baruch Hashem Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Matir Asarim, who frees those who are in prison. Sabtai Tzvi had a blessing that you would perform when you would eat this not kosher food. Matir Isurim. Who permits the forbidden. He changed with a slight vowelization adjustment. He changes who releases the imprisoned to who permits the forbidden. And says, so you make this bracha that I'm going to, that God is now, because it's the Messianic era, do the forbidden area, eat this, and they're swallowing it whole. He declares two new holidays, the day of the revival of Sabtai Tzvi, which is, of course, the 17th of Tammuz, and the birthday of Sabtai Tzvi celebration, which, of course, is Tisha B'Av. So according to Sabtai Tzvi, these fasts are abolished. And all of his followers are amazed at the conclusive proof of Nathan of Gaza's interpretation of Sabtai Tzvi. Because here he is, not only imprisoned by his own inner workings, but now the outside world is simply confirming what we knew. By the Turks, by placing him in a prison, have given physical manifestation to the battle raging inside Sabtai Tzvi. He's in a battle to repair the vessels of the universe, imprisoned by these forces of evil, but he will break out. And now the physical world Look at that, how it's reenacting the mystical process going on. Everything that happens confirms in their minds that this man is the Messiah and he's going to redeem them. Yeah, so that's the diagnosis. I would definitely call it, if mass gullibility is too harsh, a complete lack of healthy, rational skepticism, which the human race is more than capable of. Finally, he's brought to the Sultan's court for his trial. There are different accounts of what actually happened in the room, but it comes down to this. Basically, he's given a choice. We've had it with your garbage. You can become a Muslim, or we're going to chop you into little tiny pieces. What would you like, sir? He says, I will take option A, the Muslim thing. How does that go? And he converts to Islam, changes his name to Aziz Mehmed Efendi, and then, for, I think, understandable reasons this time, sinks into a dark depression. Now, the news gets out. The Messiah has converted to Islam. That doesn't sound right. Oops. Well, is it oops? First, of course, people simply don't believe it. But eventually it's confirmed. Now what do you do? It's not just oops. And here's the problem. The real problem is, and again this goes back to that point at the beginning from Rav Kook, it's not that they thought that the Messiah was coming. It's not that they thought this guy will be the Messiah. It's that the Messiah had come. We were living in the Messianic age. It began. I sold my house. It's imminent. It's not something about to happen. It's not Yichalta de Geula. This is the Geula. So if he converts to Islam now, I have to reassign my entire idea of everything going on around me. It's not that I had a theory about what was going to happen and so I guess I was wrong, so I'll revise it. I understand what's happening right now. And you tell me that he converted to Islam, there were people who simply couldn't make the shift. He lost many followers, but not all. A large number of his followers stayed faithful. Nathan himself does not waver for a second. At first, he comes up empty. He hears about it. He's shocked. He says, there's some deep mystery going on here. I don't know what it is. Give me a little time to put it together. It takes him from November till April, and he gets it. I know what it is. It's so simple, I don't know how I missed it. He has been wrestling with the klipot all along, trying to repair these vessels. He's doing it again. We have repaired all the damage done to the Jewish world. Well, somebody has to go out there into the non-Jewish world and repair their broken vessels. How is he going to do that? He has to go into their world like a spy undercover, become a Muslim, and from there, repair the damages to the rest of the world. This is just a stage. It's just another manifestation of what we've been seeing all along. Don't let it throw you. Don't let it fool you. It's the same as eating. What's the difference between this and eating chalev? Okay, it's a little different. But it's not so different. The eating chalev also was bringing the sparks out of the vessels. So when he ate not kosher food, he was bringing sparks out of vessels. And when he prays to Allah, he's bringing sparks out of vessels. It's the same thing. I don't know what confused us. Obviously, this is not a problem. This is not a setback. That's astonishing. The ability to believe something when you are locked into, when you're painted into that corner, that's astonishing. A Messiah who converted to Islam, and the movement is strong. At this point, though, in 1669, Jacob Sesportus, who had been quietly arguing against Sabtai Tzvi, where he thought it was safe, now, after the conversion, is able to openly argue against it. And I mean openly. He begins publishing both philosophical things, tearing apart Nathan of Gaza's whole scheme, mocking poems and jokes and satire against this behavior. And he feels safe to do so. after the apostasy of Shabtai Tzvi. It doesn't change the minds of people in the movement. People who moved away from the movement see why, feel maybe a little bit more stupid from it. Either he was able to recognize his folly, or he wasn't, and he stayed, and he, devastating, forget emotionally, he's got no house, he's got no job, the non-Jews who he's been doing business with think he's an idiot, at best. How do you resume life? This is devastating, economically, socially, emotionally, and now you have a split Jewish community. You have Shabbateans and non-Shabbateans. This is a disaster. In Yemen, there is a massacre of the Jews for all this messianic stuff. There are not too many, but there are massacres because of this messianic fervor. Shabtai Tzvi lives till 1672 in Turkey. He leads this weird cult of Jews for Allah. Yeah.
The remnants are still living.
The Donne. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they have a website, actually. He briefly gets arrested for immoral behavior. And Nathan moves to the Balkans and leads a group of Shabbateans there. He dies on Yom Kippur in 1676. Now, that's a very poetic time to die, and that might, you know, kind of make people feel good. You know, there's only one problem. He's dead. That's the problem. That is definitely a bump in the road. Well, what are you going to say now? What? This is not new. He's not dead. There were some who say the incarnation that converted to Islam, which was a sort of holographic Shabtai Tzvi, is what died. But the actual Shabtai Tzvi is mystically reuniting with the cosmos and will return. It goes on and on from there. But it's coming. And Nathan of Gaza, by the way, is shameless in his predictions, because 6066 has passed, and he keeps doing one of these, you know, the line is here, okay, the line is here, okay, the line is here. Next, this is it, this year, 3 weeks, it's coming, 3 weeks go by, in 2 more weeks, I'm telling you, this time it's true, and people believe him. It's astonishing. The movement survives and thrives after his death. After Nathan dies, it survives. 300 families in Salonika convert to Islam to follow in the Messiah's footsteps in 1683. That's the beginning of the Donne sect. This group of Jews, Muslims, who believe that we will make the Messiah re-manifest by repeating his actions. In 1700, there's a mass Aliyah of Sabbateans. They figure, well, maybe when Israel will speed up this second coming. Their group breaks out between the normative and the antinomian, those who say that, look, a Jew's a Jew, Shulchan Aruch is Shulchan Aruch, you act like a Jew, we just know the Mashiach is Shabtai Tzvi, and those who are performing inappropriate acts. And so that group in Israel sort of polarizes and breaks apart. 1721 is the death of the Donne leader, Baruch Yeruso, who explained that the 36 prohibitions of the Torah that get you spiritual excision are now commandments. So that everything forbidden by the Torah on punishment of your soul being destroyed are now actions we must perform. So that includes, you realize, bizarre sexual behavior, including incest.
That was responsible recently for almost a riot which engulfed radio station of a popular DJ in Turkey, because he accused an popular figure of being a member of the gun.
That's bizarre.
Yes.
Scholars, in 1725, Yonatan Apschitz begins to publicly criticize Sabbateanism because he is accused of being a Sabbatean, one of the major religious scholarly figures of his generation, and he never shakes that accusation. Yaakov Emden becomes a anti-Sabbatean debunker, the other great scholar of that generation, and begins reporting and publishing exposés on individuals and how do you recognize a Sabbatean and what are the code words, because they stay undercover. And when they say this or do this, you should know that doesn't mean what you think it means. It really means blah, 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 blah. One of the people he pursues is Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who he exposes as a Sabbatean. He almost certainly wasn't, but his life is ruined. He's driven out of Italy, moves to Amsterdam. Again, he's chased out of Amsterdam, moves to Israel, and dies at a young age. His life was ruined because he was mystical. That there's no question. And some of his language may sound somewhat similar because it's mystical. But he was almost certainly, he specifically articulates that he is not a Sabbatean, but his life is ruined just for sounding like it. Jacob Frank, in 1760, begins, Jacob Frank is this bizarre figure. He's this chameleon-like figure. Everywhere he goes, he's like Zelig. He becomes the atmosphere he's in. He comes from Turkey, where he met with the Donner, comes back to Poland, and converts to Catholicism. Says, we got to do that. That's great. Becomes Catholic, gets a bunch of Jews to become these Jews for Jesus Catholics, really gets into this whole 36 prohibition thing, and becomes this bizarre orgiastic cult. The church, at first, is very excited. They say, this is the best thing since Pablo Cristiani. We're going to get him in debates against Jews to disprove them. We're going to invite him. He testified at blood libel trials explaining that Jews really do put the blood of Christians in. He was great until they let him talk too much, and then he started... He was not a scholar. He had this bizarre, simplified version of... He started explaining to them that he was the Messiah. And he is not the second coming, because Jesus isn't the real Messiah. That didn't go over very well. And the last thing I put on is the death of the Baal Shem Tov, who fought vigorously against the Frankists, who said that there is a limit. The poor Baal Shem Tov, who, as we said at the beginning, was accused of having pieces of Sabbateanism in his approach, vigorously fought against the Frankists. He said this is the quote attributed to him. I don't know if it's accurate. He says, you know, when there's a limb that's not well, you try to repair it, but once it's amputated, there's nothing you can do with it. These people have to be fought. And this person who was trying to absorb all Jews into a deeper faith vehemently opposed the Frankists. And here's what happens in the Hasidic world. If you take away the messianic aspects of Shabtai Tzvi, if you say he's not bringing instant redemption to the world, you simply say he is the most holy man alive, his soul is incredibly special, he is a direct conduit between us and God, and the actions he performs are crucial for the development of the universe, you just leave out the Messiah, you get a Rebbe. What Hasidut did was, it took the Sabbatean role and just took the Messiah part out. And so now you have this religiously potent figure, the Rebbe, the Tzaddik, philosophically. And all it really took was the slightest nudge to slap that label back on. That's all it took in the 20th century. It was a very similar role, just without the messianic pretension.
And also without the sinning, too.
I hope so. I don't know. Again, when we talk about Sabbateans, we're talking about a whole range of people. And unfortunately, right now, there are a whole range of strange behaviors and beliefs going on right now. I'm not predicting that it will inflame to the level of Shabtai Tzvi. I don't think that's really possible. But the parallels are more than disturbing. Next week, now that we've gotten all cynical and depressed at these false messiahs, next week we will try to come to terms with, so what exactly is it we do believe? What are the positive feelings we are supposed to have and look forward to?
Sure.
Who?
The modern church.
Who's that?
He's a father of the modern church.
Really?
Yes. And he's accused of having Jewish blood. You know, he stopped Muslims, don't you?
No.
Anywhere.
But that's pretty typical.
Well, guys, he did that. Anywhere. The low estimate is from 2015.
Wow.
We are here to announce that the upshot is the next week is bringing the sign.
That'd be cool.
I chose for that.
Yeah, me too.
What is that?
The Zohar is a 14th century Kabbalistic composition. It's mostly a Perush on the Torah, but it's other things. And it's. Yeah. Absolutely. The Zohar.
Yeah.
But whatever it is, he didn't come along.
He did not just create it. That's correct. He was extremely creative, but he took old ideas and crystallized them and reformatted them and added new imagery.